תגור אינונה ברשותן אדור קושו ניגים יחדית אינונה ישבית קימן נורפת ביער הרפוצי גרים מקונק נניה Inuim Nayari Me.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in the V-berth of a Valiant 42, motoring up the Chesapeake Bay, covered in black biting flies. Yeah, so you might be able to hear, I got a fan going in the background because it's hot. And the motor is going. I don't know if you can hear the 44 horsepower Westerbeek that's moving this boat along right now. I think the wind is coming back a little bit. I can feel it starting to come back. another delivery should be, I don't know if it'll be the last one for the season. Maybe another one will pop up. Deliveries are kind of funny that way. There's certainly a season where boats come up, and then another season in the fall when the boats go down. I kind of like the spring better, to be honest, because it's easier sailing. In the fall, going south can be a bit more difficult. And it seems to be longer trips. I don't know. I seem to do a lot more Caribbean trips for whatever reason. Annapolis to typically the Virgin Islands. So that, but if you're doing that, basically, when you leave out of Chesapeake Bay, you make a waypoint, I don't know, 100 miles south of Bermuda. And head sort of for that waypoint. Now, depending on weather and how good of weather forecasting information you're able to receive, you might be able to change that course to maybe a more direct, you know, rum line or whatever, a direct line to where you're trying to get to. But what people do is they make the mistake of trying to go south too early on and not getting enough easting in. When you want to sail the Caribbean, you want to get your easting in. Because once you get, you know, further south, let's say, I don't know, south of 30 or something like that, you're going to start getting into easterlies. And if you go south too quickly and you don't get enough easting in, then you're going to be beating into it for that last stretch into those easterlies. Or at least that's more than likely what's going to happen, you know. I mean, there is always a chance you'll have different wind conditions, but generally speaking, those are the winds and that's the route. You know, that's like the route the Caribbean 1500 takes and all that. I've done that route 20 times, mostly deliveries. A couple of times it was my own boat coming back from my Europe, Africa, Caribbean trip I did single-handed. I brought a boat up, my boat up with a broken engine from St. John to St. Thomas, Red Hook in St. Thomas. Brought it up from there with a broken engine, but that's a different story for a different time. This Valiant 42s are great boats. They're incredibly well built, and you know, I'm really glad in a lot of ways that this is the boat I was on for this delivery. This Valiant 42, they're a Bob Perry design, a classic design, really. Valiant 40s were built for quite some time before. They stopped building the Valiant 40s and started building the Valiant 42s, I think in the early 90s, if I remember correctly. And I know they were making Valiant 42s as early as 94, at very least. But yeah, they're a great boat. I'm glad I had it on this one, because I had a lot of wind on this particular trip. The wind at least was out of the right direction, and this is the thing that, you know, Valiant 42s were really built for, you know, were for ocean going passages, blue water sailing. I mean, a Valiant 42 is a perfect example of a well-built blue water boat, and and you hear that, and you know, they are surprisingly fast even in lighter winds. This boat in particular is called Valhalla, and she's been rigged out, brand new sails, brand new electronics, I mean, it's this boat has electric winch for the halyard, which is usually don't see. You know, it's kind of plush in that. We got a satellite radio, you know, like that Sirius satellite. Which I guess I should get into for a second. Sirius satellite, I'm not sure how far offshore it works. And it works better in some systems than it does on others. But it will give you rain, squalls, you know, lightning, thunder and lightning and all that, the storm activity. You can see them moving in on your boat, which we had a lot of this trip. But we left out of Riviera Beach City Marina, and the place had a real strong current. And it's sort of like the Ashley River over there by Charleston, South Carolina. It was just ripping through there. And so I had to wait for slack tide, get my way out, stop at a fuel dock, top off the tanks, and then head out to sea. We had favorable winds. I mean, the winds were blowing out of a southerly direction. And they built slowly over the first day, which was pretty nice. Got into the Gulf Stream, cruising at 10 knots. And we cruised at 10 knots for like 3 days straight, 4 days. I mean, it didn't take us... We got up here pretty quick. Like in 4 days, 4.5 days. 4 days right now. We've been at it for 4 days, basically. Well, we're a couple hours short of 4 days. But that's because, you know, if you go out of Florida and you catch the Gulf Stream, you can ride it up some distance. You're going to probably lose it a little bit off South Carolina to some extent. And of course, you'll pick it back up around Hatteras. The Gulf Stream is both, can be your friend and your enemy. You have to be very careful of it. It can benefit you in a sense that you're going to get a lot of extra speed out of your boat, you know. And if you have southerly winds, if the wind is blowing the same direction as the current, then the seas will actually lay down a little bit because they're both going the same direction. But, of course, if the wind is going the opposite direction of the current, like a nor'easter or something like that, you got to stay well clear of the Gulf Stream. Last delivery, I had a heave to. I think it was after I did this last podcast. I don't remember exactly. But I know we had to heave to in that Beneteau 54 on the east side of the Gulf Stream, waiting for some weather to pass before I was going to, you know, dare to cross it. And this time, the wind built to about 40 to 45 knots sustained. And then there was gusts up around 55 to 60. And lots of lightning and lots of rain for like 2 days, basically. It just rained sideways and blew harder and harder until it was, you know, up into the 40s. This boat is a great boat for that kind of weather, especially when it's coming from behind you. These Valiant 42s are awesome, you know, in that regard. That's what they're built for. Everything's a compromise with sailboats, you know. Everything's a compromise. What kind of boat you want to buy? And, you know, it's all, you know, how much room do you want inside? What kind of creature comforts do you want? You know, a Valiant 42 is not the roomiest 42, like, at all, you know. But, you know, partially because it's a double ender, and double enders just don't have as much room. But double enders is part of the idea, at least, is that having the pointy stern, when you have big following seas coming from behind you, that the sea will break over that stern, and it won't have anything to grab onto. Where if you have a big transom on the back of your boat, a big flat transom, I had on my Pearson 323 a pretty good size flat transom, and if I had a big enough breaking wave behind me and I was coming over the top of the breaking wave as I was going through like the top of that water, it would grab the backside of my boat sometimes and like push me forward as it passed me, and that would make me want to try to broach or something, you know. So it is good in the regard. Now what you do in that case is you put out a drogue, and then you put your drogue out, and then that compensates for any kind of wave trying to push you. You know, it's not as important. I have a drogue actually on this boat, a Jordan series drogue, which is a hell of a drogue. It's a really good drogue, but takes up a ton of space, and space is always a premium on these boats. But anyway, so yeah, it blew, you know, and it picked up and just reduced sail, you know, getting 30, 35, 40 knots. that I was down to just the staysail on this boat, and I even rolled in the staysail to like a first reef at about 45 knots. And that was enough, you know, that was enough to keep me moving a good 8-9 knots or so, and everything was comfortable. The autopilot couldn't compensate. After about 40 knots, the autopilot just wasn't able to keep up with the seas, because the sea state at that point had gotten big enough to kind of toss the boat around. Autopilots just can't really, a monitor wind vane would have been able to keep up with that, I don't think, without much of an issue, especially on a boat like this, because monitor wind vanes and Valiant 42s go together. They're like a perfect marriage, you know. But I had to take over for the I had to take over for the autopilot. But it was sort of a surreal experience in a way, because it was blowing 45, but it felt with stronger gusts, but it didn't feel like it, you know. The boat felt like it was blowing 20 or 25, because it's just such a well-built boat, heavy displacement. It's really designed, you know, and it had really new sail, brand new sails, really nice cruising sails, tri-radial cut main. I mean, the boat is just really, you know, souped up 6 ways from Sunday, you know. And the surreal thing was that I had that Sirius satellite radio, so I was out there, like, at the wheel, steering the boat, as, you know, the seas got up into, the 20s, like, the low 20s, you know. I mean, they weren't massive by any scale, but they were probably, like, 18 feet, 20 feet, you know, they vary, as they always do. They were also, the wind was helping in some cases. I got out of the Gulf Stream, and I lost any help I got from the Gulf Stream as far as flattening the seas. I lost it for a little while off South Carolina, which is easy to do, but I found it back again. But I was sitting out there steering the boat and listening to this sad, like, the Comedy Central has like a stand-up comedy thing, and so I'm listening to like blaring stand-up comedy. There's cockpit speakers on this boat that work perfectly fine, and so I'm listening, and, you know, I'm in this freaking gale. I mean, 40-45 knots, that's a proper gale, and it's blowing, it's raining sideways, and I'm, like, listening to a bunch of different stand-up comedy. And, you know, every, like, third or fourth punchline, you would miss it because the wind would pick up and start howling. You know, I had the speakers, like, all the way up, as loud as they could get, because I was, you know, 3 feet from the speakers. I needed to, a lot of wind in the way. So, yeah, it was kind of fun, actually. I actually had a good time. It's been a little while since I've been in that situation, since I've had a gale, really. It's been a little while since my last gale. And, I had a bunch of wind up in the Arctic, of course, last year. But that's not a gale. That's like something much more extreme. And this is a perfect boat for it. And my crew, I got a young strapping sailor who knows his stuff. So it was a good crew to have to be in that kind of weather. It was wet. I was going to do this podcast, like, in the middle of it, you know, like, oh, and it's blowing 45, I'll duck into my little aft cabin thing and do a podcast. You know, when you get off watch, and you're, like, soaking wet, and you've been standing out there at the wheel for 5 hours, I do 5 hours on, 5 hours off, and all you want to do is get in some dry clothes and try to get some sleep, you know, eat a little food, make a little sandwich or something, and drink some water and go to bed. So, yeah, I didn't really feel like doing it then. But, you know, we're motoring up to Chesapeake Bay now. We're getting near. We'll probably get to Annapolis at, like, 3 in the morning, is my guess. So, you know, whatever. That is what it is. But, and, you know, you got to be careful all the way to the finish line. You know, a trip's not over until the boat is tied off to the dock. And that's important to remember. You know, motoring up the bay after it, you know, we came up from Florida and we flew up with all this wind behind us and gales and all this lightning and all this crazy stuff. You could come into the bay and get complacent, be like, oh, and, you know, the wind's barely blowing right now. Everything's really calm, just motoring up the bay with, you know, a little bit of, we have our sails up, you know, but we're just barely able to keep them full. But you can get complacent then and not see something like a buoy and ram it. I know someone that did that. Not that long ago, $100,000 worth of damage on a boat that they rammed into a freaking giant metal channel marker in the Delaware Bay. But they're not delivering boats anymore, I'll just say that much. And that's one thing you cannot do on a delivery. the boat has to show up at point B in the same condition that it left in point A. You know, that's a basic delivery ethos, I guess. But yeah, so you know, it was a nice trip up, nice delivery. I'm glad I had a gale. On this boat with the crew I had, it was really a good time, and it was really interesting to listen to stand-up comedy while it's blowing, you know, a good solid 45, and just like hand steer your way down 20-foot waves, and you know, I was drinking orange Fanta, although waves kept breaking in my orange Fanta. Like, I tried to set it there, but you know, I was getting a lot of spray, and I couldn't quite drink my can of pop because I kept getting waves in it. It always sucks when you get waves in your freaking cans. Alrighty, we're going to cut the commercials. I'll talk to you in a minute.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford. The delivery is now over. I wrapped that delivery up about, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago. In the end, it took about 4.5 days to get to the bay. It took about 5.5 days to get from West Palm Beach, Florida to Annapolis, Maryland. I think it's about an 850-mile trip. It was pretty good timing for a Valiant 42. You know, Valiant 42s aren't necessarily known as being the fastest boats in the ocean, but they can sure take a whole lot of wind and not be affected much by it. They're a really, really well-built boat. All the Valiants are really well-built boats. I was speaking briefly in the last segment while I was still on the delivery about satellite weather, serious satellite weather. And, you know, I just want to touch up on it before I move away from this. Serious satellite weather can be a good way to get some aspects of a weather forecast in the ocean. I have seen it set up on boats where it didn't work very well at all, and I've seen it set up on boats like this last Valiant 42 where it worked really, really well, but it has its limitations. So let's look at the positive side first. The positive side of this system is that you can get precipitation, which I think is one of the best things it does. So basically it shows you the clouds with rain in it. It shows you the clouds that have lightning, and you can actually track these clouds. Let's say you're 100 miles offshore, and these clouds are moving at, I don't know, 35 mile an hour or 40 mile an hour or something, and you're 100 miles offshore. So it's going to get to you in like 2.5 hours. So you can track these clouds as they come off, let's say, the Carolinas or wherever you are, and you can track them as they move towards your boat. And you'll be able to tell because of different colors if it's red or you know, obviously red is extreme winds, but, you know, there's a color system that will tell you how much wind is in the cloud. You'll see a lightning bolt if there's lightning in the cloud. And that's really the only thing that radar is good for anymore, in my opinion. Radar works really, really well when you're in the fog, and if you're going to sail in an area that has a lot of fog, then it's a great idea to have a radar. But with AIS, we know where all the freighters are, and if you have this Sirius satellite overlay on your chart plotter, you can see if it's done properly.
You can see all the clouds. The clouds were the only other thing to use the radar for besides fog. And, you know, you can use the radar to try to track the cloud, the squall, although that's a little tricky to do. And there's a MARPA function on a radar that's supposed to help you track. But the MARPA function is sort of a joke. It's easily confused. So outside of having a boat in the fog, there isn't really much reason to have radar anymore. Now, that said, that really depends on what you're doing. So obviously there might be reasons you might want to have radar. But that said, the beauty of it is that you can get these clouds. You can get temperatures. There's even a function on this called fishing that actually showed the different temperatures of the water, which allowed me to see vaguely where the Gulf Stream was located, which is great. You can look, and there's a Gulf Stream right there on your chart plotter. So that's all the positives. The negative side is you cannot, although they claim they can give you a weather report, I think it's 48 hours out. The weather reports you get are not that great. So there's much, much better systems, like the Predict Wind offshore program as the one that I use. But there's much better systems for actually getting good weather forecasts. When I say that, I mean wind speed and wind direction. That's what matters. Which speed is the wind going to blow, and what direction is it going to blow out of? Those are the only two things you really need to know outside of what time is it going to happen. What time is it going to happen, where is it coming from, and so on. So Sirius isn't that reliable for that. It's okay, but it's not great. And really the big Achilles heel with the Sirius system is that it only works a couple hundred miles offshore, and I think it only covers part of the Caribbean. I don't think it covers anywhere else in the world. I'm not even sure how much of the West Coast. I'd imagine it covers the West Coast. I'm not sure. But, it's not like using a Iridium-based communication system where you're getting GRIB files that you're loading into a program that gives you accurate forecasts anywhere in the world. So, anyways, I don't want to take too much time with that. I just wanted to give the ups and downs of Sirius Weather Radio. I don't want to have too many episodes in a row here about climate change. I like to switch things up, but since this Paris Accord, the Paris Treatment, we just got out of the Paris Treatment agreement. I mean, I'd like to go over what is that? What was the Paris Agreement? Why in the world did we get out of it? And what was so bad for us, the United States? So the whole premise, basically, of this Paris Agreement is that we are trying to prevent the Earth from warming more than 2 degrees centigrade. So 2 degrees centigrade, I don't know, that's 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the magic mark. And they say, the scientific community in general, say that if the Earth were to warm more than 2 degrees centigrade, that it could start irreversible, sort of catastrophic effects. Screwing up weather patterns, for instance, where maybe you're getting rain where usually you got droughts. You're getting droughts where you used to get rain. That would screw up a lot of things. It would just exacerbate sea level rise, because as the Earth gets warmer, there's less ice in the polar regions. And now picture the Arctic. The Arctic is a big chunk of floating ice. It's white. White surfaces reflect sunlight. So the less white surface, the less ice we have in the Arctic, the less of a device we have to bounce some of the sun's energy back off the Earth. So it sort of adds up here. But, it's the whole point of this Paris Agreement was to try to limit the climate change to less than 2 degrees centigrade, and that was it. So what they did is they did something called a carbon budget, and the carbon budget is already mostly full. We're at least 75% of our way through our carbon budget already, and the carbon budget is directly connected with this 2 degrees centigrade mark. So if we exceed the carbon budget, chances are we're also going to raise the global temperature by more than 2 degrees centigrade, putting us in this potentially catastrophic situation that's pretty much irreversible. So once this agreement was signed, every 5 years, we would all meet back up again, and we would sort of go over the agreement and we'd fine tune it. And that was it. You know, you signed the agreement. Every single country signed it except for Syria and Nicaragua. These are the only two countries that didn't sign it. Syria didn't sign it because they're in the middle of a civil war. The civil war has been going on for years now. They got their plate full, you know, so I'm not surprised that Syria didn't sign it. Their whole country is ripped apart right now, and it's complete chaos going on in Syria. So, okay, yeah, they didn't sign it. The reason Nicaragua didn't sign it is because they believed that the wealthy countries were not doing enough in the agreement. So they didn't sign it because they thought it was stupid. They didn't sign it because they didn't think the countries like the United States was doing enough in the agreement. So here we are hanging out with Syria and Nicaragua. The really interesting thing, or one of the breakthroughs about this agreement, was that we were able to get China and India to sign the agreement. You know, China and India both have over a billion people. They're becoming more advanced. They're becoming wealthier. As time goes on, they're going to be burning more and more fossil fuels. And, you know, there's, think about a billion people. How many cars, how many, you know, heaters, how much electricity, you know. So it was big that in the past we could never get China on board. So we were able to get China on board. We were able to get India on board. We were able to get every single other country on board except for Syria and Nicaragua. Now, Trump says that this puts us at an economic disadvantage and that it's going to hurt U.S. business. It's interesting that he says it's going to hurt U.S. business. 25 of the most major companies in the country tried to reach out to Donald Trump saying that, you know, we want to stay in the agreement. One of these 25 companies was Exxon. I mean, it's pretty bad when even Exxon Mobil is saying, let's stay in the agreement, and you're not doing it, you know. In 1977, Exxon Mobil basically discovered that climate change was happening. And for the next 11 years, they didn't say anything. It took about 11 years. It took about 1988 before this started to become a public conversation. And it wasn't until the early 2000s, after Al Gore lost to George Bush, and Al Gore started doing a lot promoting climate change research, or promoting this idea of climate change and global warming, that's when this really became a big national topic. But anyways, in 1977, ExxonMobil figured out that something was happening because they spend a lot of money doing research. And they actually spent a lot more money on a whole misinformation campaign. At one point in time, cigarette companies, you know, doctors and dentists used to actually promote cigarette companies. And at some point, people realized cigarettes were actually really deadly. And companies like Philip Morris put a lot of money into misinformation campaigns, you know, in the 60s and in the 70s. ExxonMobil did the same basic thing. They put a lot of money into misinformation. It doesn't look like Exxon's doing that anymore, because ExxonMobil is one of the 25 companies telling Donald Trump we should stay in this agreement. So, you know, it's really Scott Pruitt and Steve Bannon who were really behind this. I mean, it wasn't really Donald Trump. It was, those were the two people, Scott Pruitt and Steve Bannon, who really pulled the strings behind the scenes to, and you know, and when Donald Trump was running for election, he was saying, oh, climate change is a hoax created by China, you know, which is just completely crazy. And then he's saying, oh, well, according to this agreement, you know, China and India can burn coal and we can't burn as much coal. And he keeps going back to coal. You know, I feel bad for coal miners, man. I mean, I'm from Ohio. Pennsylvania is my neighbor. And, you know, I know these people are hardworking, salt of the earth, blue collared people working in these coal mines. But unfortunately, we're moving away from coal, as we should be moving away from coal. And yes, people are going to lose their jobs. I think it would be great if they tried to put like a factory that builds solar panels in one of these coal towns. So then if all the coal jobs close, well, now they can get a job making solar panels. That would be great if they did something like that. But the reality is a lot of these people are going to end up losing their jobs at some point in the future because we're just moving away from coal as our entire planet is moving away from coal, especially the more developed countries. Now, let's look at coal and the job force. Right now, which, by the way, before I get into that, Donald Trump said specifically that China can burn coal and India can burn coal, but we can't burn coal. And the word coal is not in the Paris Agreement. Nowhere in that agreement is the word coal anywhere in there. But if you're looking at coal in the United States, about 160,000 people work within the coal industry. 160,000. We got 374,000 people that work within solar, and we got 102,000 people that work within wind power. So you already have the renewable resources is already many times more employees than you have within coal. What I would like to see is a way we can figure out how to move away from coal without these coal miners losing their jobs. You know, that's really, you know, what it comes down to. So the Green Climate Fund is what this fund is behind this Paris treaty. And Trump says this would likely obligate the U.S. to commit potentially tens of billions of dollars to this cause. That's absurd. Nowhere in there does it say anything about tens of billions of dollars potentially. We have committed $3 billion. That's what we committed, $3 billion. Yes, we are paying more than anybody else, but we are also wealthier than everybody else. So let's look at this a little differently. If you look at $3 billion, the amount of money we're putting into it, and then you look at the amount of money other countries are putting into it, taking account their gross national product, we're actually number 32 on the list as far as the amount of money we have versus the amount of money we're spending. So if you take gross national product into the equation, we're actually number 32 on the list. So, you know, this idea that the deal isn't fair and the deal isn't fair for the United States, the whole thing was voluntary. You know, there was no regulations put in place. There's no penalties put in place. We technically didn't have to do anything. Nobody is forced into doing anything in this agreement. All we're doing is saying that, yeah, okay, we'll try to curb some of our carbon emissions and we'll try to help keep the Earth below this 2 degrees centigrade increase. We all agree that it would suck if it gets above 2 degrees centigrade, and we're just going to do our best to try to keep a cap on it. That's all we're agreeing to. We're not agreeing to actually physically doing anything that there's a penalty. You know, it's all voluntary, the whole agreement. So in other words, we didn't need to pull out of this agreement. We could have just said, look, we're not going to do it, and they wouldn't have kicked us out. We still would have been part of the agreement. And it just makes us look bad to the world. And I don't know if maybe Trump supporters don't travel much. You know, I don't know. I mean, the best education you can get is to go out there and see the world. The best way you can understand your own country is by visiting other countries. The best way you can understand your own culture is by visiting other cultures. And, you know, so maybe some of these people just don't get out much. I don't know. I don't know what to make about it anymore. And, you know, it's just there's no talking sense to these people who are climate change deniers. It's like trying to tell a devout Christian something about their religion. They're not going to listen to anything you have to say. You know, these people, the deniers aren't going to listen to anything you have to say. It's just, you know, whatever. Anyways, I don't want to keep going on about this. The whole thing is ridiculous. We should never have got out of the agreement. And it just makes us look bad globally. But, you know, we're in America, so we're the greatest country, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, I got to cut the commercial break.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio.
Time goes forward, go and catch your jet. You will find your moment.
Bonnie Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielasscharters.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in the office of Rogue Wave Yacht Sales / David Walters Yacht Sales. We're technically part of David Walters at this point. But it's all one big happy family. So I think last time I was in Amsterdam, I had just come back from building a cruising kitty, and I was sick as a dog. And yeah, okay. So it was early April. I came back to the Netherlands. It was March. It was still kind of cold, and I was sick, and my boat was covered in mold, and ugh. I get better. I clean the boat. And I spent a few weeks sailing around the Netherlands. The Netherlands is really interesting because it's all these canals. And so because of the canals, you don't have any tide difference. And also because of the canals, you often have deep water all the way up to the side. You know, it's like a swimming pool. You know, it stays deep all the way up to the side. So you just sort of tie off wherever you can and tie off to whatever you can tie off to. So I went up to northern Netherlands, up to a place called Markham or something like that. And I sailed around a bit. And, you know, it was still April. It was still kind of cold. But whatever. It was, you know, neat, interesting enough. And I came back into Amsterdam, and I had a girl come in to meet me, to sail with me, this girl Whitney, who I had known for years. I hadn't seen Whitney in probably 8 years at this point. She went off and started doing, like, professional snowboarding, like, on competition. She would, like, take a helicopter to the top of a mountain in Alaska and, like, jump out of the helicopter with a snowboard and, like, go down these mountains that I would break my neck just looking at the mountain. Like, I don't think I could get down this mountain with a freaking ladder and a rope and an ice axe, you know, let alone flying, like, 80 miles an hour straight down this crazy mountain. So anyways, she did that like competitively. So obviously the girl wasn't afraid of much, but she had no sailing experience at all. So she gets on the boat in Amsterdam, and you know, we're in a canal, so it's super flat. And just the motion of our bodies, this is a 32-foot boat, a 323 Pearson, just the motion of our bodies moving around is moving the boat ever so slightly. And just that tiny, tiny motion of us walking around on the boat and moving it was enough to get her seasick. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, this girl's getting seasick in a canal with, like, the tiniest movement you could ever imagine. So I'm like, well, what's the best way to cure this one? So when we sailed from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam, back across the North Sea to England, I decided to do it in a gale. I said, well, you know, there's a gale blowing, and we could have waited a couple of days for the gale to pass, but I figured, well, hell, I might as well give her, you know, baptism by fire. If she's going to get seasick that easy, let's take her out in the ocean and see, let's crank this baby up and see what happens, you know? So I fed her a Dramamine. We went offshore. It was blowing 35 to 40, and we had it coming up from our quarter, so the wind was blowing up from behind us. It was from the right direction. But, and we made great time. I think I did 165 miles in 24 hours, which on a 32-foot boat was really good timing. But she curled up in a ball, basically, inside the boat and just slept. I just kept feeding her Dramamine. And I know this sounds a bit crazy, and this might even sound a little bit cruel to knowingly take somebody who gets seasick easily offshore in a gale.
But there was a good strategy behind it. I knew that most people who get seasick will get used to it, and over time will be less and less likely to get seasick. There are some people out there who will never get over being seasick. They're completely impossible. But it's a very, very small percentage of the population who has that severe of an issue with motion sickness. So most people get seasick because they're just not used to being on the boats. And the more that you're on the boat, the more you're going to get used to it. And I knew that if I went out there and got, you know, threw her into this gale, that that she was, you know, that everything after that was going to be less. And that was the case for the most part. We sailed back, you know, it's difficult to go west in the English Channel because that's against the prevailing winds. But we bounced, you know, France, England, sort of bouncing back across the English Channel, went off to the Isles of Scilly, which are a little island chain off southwest England. And they get really mad if you call them the Scilly Isles. Now, these are not Scilly Isles. Anyways, they're the Isles of Scilly. But we left out of there. Again, I saw a lot of weather coming, but it was in the right direction. And I guess there's also a time in my life where I had had a lot of bad weather. And so I was used to dealing with it, and I was comfortable with it. But at the same time, I hadn't had enough bad weather where I was tired of it. Like now, I'm at the point where I've been through enough storms and enough gales. Like, typically speaking, I don't really want to deal with that anymore. You know, and it's like, and there was a time when I was younger when it was like, yahoo, let's go sail out into the middle of a gale. But at this point in my life, it's like, all right, I've already done that a bunch of times. So anyways, it was a force 9, force 8, force 9. It was about a 600-mile passage from the Isles of Scilly off of southwest England down to San Sebastian, Spain, where I was heading. And San Sebastian is right at the corner of France and Spain on the Atlantic coast. So we left, and it was blowing hard. And we were given this chart by this lady in the Isles of Scilly. I had sailed there the previous year in 2008. So I was a little familiar with it, but she gave us half a chart. I didn't have a proper chart. I don't remember what the circumstance. For some reason, I asked the lady at the Isles of Scilly at like some information thing to print me off a chart. So she printed me off this chart, but it was missing like a little section. And the section it was missing had a bunch of rocks right below the water. So we come cruising out. It's blowing like 45 knots blowing probably 40 at this point. And and we sail off this little chart. And I start seeing rocks around us. Like, I look over and I see a freaking rock sticking up. It's not that far away. And I'm thinking, oh, shit. And but anyways, whatever. I mean, we got past it. You know, technology has changed a lot since that time. I mean, 2008, 2009 wasn't that long ago. But back then, I didn't have chart overlay on my chart plotter. I just had a Latin long and, you know, course over ground, speed over ground. And you know, you just use cruising guides and you use charts the best you can, but it's hard to get charts for everywhere. So anyways, we went sailing off, and this girl, Whitney, by this point had basically become immune to seasickness. I had worked her through it. And so she went through a force 8, force 9, force 8. She didn't have any problems. She never got seasick once. And, the force 9, we were in the Bay of Biscay. Bay of Biscay is this really nasty piece of water off of, it's sort of, if you know where Brittany in France is, that whole Atlantic west coast of France down to the north coast of Spain is this Bay of Biscay. And in Europe, you hear all these nightmares about it, you know, these horror stories about the Bay of Biscay. And the part of the Spanish coast by La Coruña is actually called the Coast of Dead Souls. So whatever, I've heard horror stories before, and you know, Cape Hatteras is supposed to be our graveyard of the Atlantic. Bay of Biscay is their graveyard of the Atlantic. And I saw, yeah, sure, whatever. I've heard it all before, blah, blah, blah. But they called that for a good reason. So I ended up going, you know, that was hubris on my behalf, acting that way. And I ended up getting a really bad knockdown. We were cruising along in this Force 9. Next thing I know, the freaking mast is in the water. You know, the boat is on its side. And we're getting thrown across the inside of the cabin. And that was the first knockdown I had ever had on that boat. I had stronger winds crossing the Atlantic, but it's just something about how the waves are in the Bay of Biscay. It's just a nasty piece of water. So the Force 8 was coming, and by this point, we didn't have good weather forecasting back then. I didn't have Euridium, and I didn't have predict wind or any of this sort of stuff. So basically, you get a weather forecast when you leave, but after a few days at sea, that weather forecast, it stops being reliable. And basically, you know, for the second half of our trip, the first 3 days we had it, the second 3 days, we didn't really have any weather. So I saw a passing ship, and I called him on the VHF, and I asked him about weather, and he said Force 8 imminent. And, Force 8 imminent. We just had a Force 8 and a Force 9. It's been blowing hard for, like, you know, 4 days solid at this point. And so I say, what the hell? Let's try this parachute sea anchor. I've never deployed a parachute sea anchor before. And if you talk to people, most people who have parachute sea anchors, they never use them. So I said, well, what the hell? I was sort of tired of dealing with it. And I said, yeah, this is a good opportunity to test this out. So we deployed the parachute sea anchor, put it off the bow, and it was great. It worked. It was marvelous. I had a wind generator on the back of the boat, and because it was blowing so hard, I was getting a ton of power from my wind generator. It was getting to the point where I needed to tie my wind generator off. You know, it was damn near blowing too strong, but it was just right, you know, just at its maximum output. So I had a ton of power. So I'm sitting there with Whitney, and, you know, we're going to be tied to a parachute sea anchor for like 12 hours because, you know, it's going to take a while for it to go on. And it's starting to get dark, you know, and I say, well, you know, Whitney, we're just going to, you know, let's just sleep through the night. And, you know, but what do you want to do? You know, it's sort of boring and we're getting tossed around. So I go through my movie collection and I say, okay, what the hell? Let's watch Perfect Storm. So we ended up sitting in this gale in the Bay of Biscay on a parachute sea anchor watching The Perfect Storm, you know, in a storm, basically, which I thought was hilarious. Whitney wasn't as keen on the idea, but I thought it was hilarious, you know. And then we went to bed. I slept like 8 hours. I slept like a baby. And then I woke up in the morning and Whitney woke up. We made a cup of coffee. We pulled the parachute sea anchor and we got back on our way. So, yeah, my first experience using a parachute sea anchor, everything was actually really nice. And I've used one, I don't know how many times since then. Going around the Americas, I had to use one quite a bit. I've used one more often than I'd like to. But anyways, we get down to San Sebastian after 6 days being at sea. And we found the free mooring ball, which is great. Although I had to row like miles to get to the dock. I didn't have an outboard engine. I didn't have a proper dinghy. I had one of these Avon Red Crests. They're inflatable all the way around. They don't have like a wooden transom on the back. They're inflatable on the back. They're a freaking joke. But the beauty of these dinghies is they're such giant pieces of crap that nobody's ever going to steal it. So I never had to worry about somebody stealing my dinghy because it was a horrible piece of junk. But in this case, I remember just rowing it took me like an hour of hard rowing to get there. But anyway, San Sebastian's a beautiful place. They're known for their tapas. If you're a fan of tapas, San Sebastian is like the tapa capital of the world. Beautiful architecture, part of Basque country. Basque are separatists that live in both France and Spain, right at the French-Spanish border. Basques, there was a time when they were sort of like, I don't know, I think terrorists would probably be taking it a little too far, but there was a time when they were blowing some stuff up and they were fighting these Basque separatists. But the Basques, they are, if you go into the next couple of towns I sailed into were true Basque country, where they only speak Basque. They don't speak Spanish when you're walking around town. And they do stay to themselves. They're not very inviting or very friendly. No, they're friendly. They're just not very inviting. But it's really cool. You know, they got great cheese, great bread, great wine. It was really a beautiful part of the trip. And so I'm going to leave off there because I need to spend some time talking about Spain. And I don't have enough time to properly give it justice because the northwest coast of Spain is one of the most beautiful places in Europe probably the most beautiful place in Europe I've ever sailed. and Ireland was pretty damn beautiful. So, you know, I'm also, like I said, I'm working for David Walters Yachts. So what I'm trying to do is help connect people with boats that make sense for your budget and where you're going. So if you're going, if you're going to sail around the world, or if you're going to sail to the Caribbean, you're going to need two vastly different boats. You could sail to the Caribbean with the boat you sail around the world on, but if you want to do blue water sailing, proper blue water sailing, you really need a blue water boat. There's a whole ocean of boats out there that, and within those boats, there's going to be lemons, there's going to be giant money traps that if you buy that boat, you're going to dump $100,000 into it. And there's other boats where the previous owner had already dumped $100,000 into it. So what I try to do is I try to connect people with turnkey boats. I try to get you a boat where the previous owner had already dumped all the money into it, so you don't have to. Or if you're looking for a fixer-upper, if you're okay with doing your own work, then let's find a boat that's the cheapest possible boat on the market that's a fixer-upper that's not that bad. You know, I mean, I'm not saying get the cheapest boat, but let's get one that's a fixer-upper, but it's nothing crazy. You know, it has a good engine, has a good rig, has good sails. It just needs some TLC. So anyways, I'd love to help you get a boat. And if you got a listing, check us out. We sell some of the finest boats made at David Walters. So you can contact me at matt@roguewaveyachtsales.com, or just give me a call at 443-254-3909. Also, check out Ocean Research Project. Check the website out, www.oceanresearchproject.org. You can see videos from last year's expedition, and you can always make a donation via PayPal on the website. Thank you very much, guys, and I'll talk to you here soon.
Unum ko na uswag. Doon na kasi. Kuya na kurok. Kuya na kasi. Kuya na uswag. Should I keep my good?